and welcome. Today is Friday, October the 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump makes more controversial statements.
The results of this great and historic presidential election.
Americans are stressed over the presidential campaign. As civilians flee Mosul in Iraq, another refugee crisis could unfold. Also ahead, a review of the latest Tom Cruise movie that's just hitting U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, we begin with the U.S. presidential campaign. Donald Trump is again making headlines for a comment he made during Wednesday night's debate, a day after his stunning refusal in the final presidential debate to say whether he would concede to Clinton if he loses. He said this at a campaign stop in Ohio.
I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election if I win.
Well, his resistance, threatening to undermine the essence of American democracy, was roundly rejected by fellow Republicans and by President Obama, who was campaigning on Thursday for Hillary Clinton and had this response.
This is more than just the usual standard lie. Because when you suggest rigging or fraud without a shred of evidence, when last night at the debate, Trump becomes the first major party nominee in American history to suggest that he will not concede despite losing the vote, and then says today that he will accept the results if he wins, that is not a joking matter. No, I want everybody to pay attention here. That is dangerous. Because when you try to sow the seeds of doubt in people's minds about the legitimacy of our elections, that undermines our democracy. Then you're doing the work of our adversaries for them.
While widespread election fraud has been extremely rare in U.S. politics in modern times, digging deeper into this, Mark Rozelle is the dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, and he gives his take on Trump's refusal to say whether he would accept the election results.
It's not only unique for a presidential nominee of a major party to say that he may not accept the legitimacy of the outcome. It's absolutely unprecedented in American presidential history. So a lot of people are very concerned about that, but I would just caution to those who worry that somehow this is going to have some long-standing effect on the American political process that this is not for Donald Trump to decide. It's for the Electoral College to decide, and once the Electoral College certifies that either he or Hillary Clinton has won the presidency, that's it. And the loser can say, I congratulate my opponent, or refuse to do so and say the election was not legitimate. But the loser really doesn't have any say in the outcome. So you can see right now many major figures in the Republican Party are condemning what Mr. Trump said in the debate. And they're making it very clear that our electoral democracy stands strong and the winner is accorded legitimacy and we unite behind the president after the election's over. That's the way things work. So I think Mr. Trump at a certain point will just become an angry outlier and most people in the political system will simply ignore him at that point. It's been an extraordinary election year, of course. That goes without saying. But one of the things that makes it so is the fact that you have this fellow who is a non-traditional politician by any standard, never having held any public office in his life, having defeated the Republican establishment. And to be very clear, the establishment wing of the party tried to vanquish him all through the nomination process, and they failed. And Mr. Trump feels he owes them nothing. You know, here he stands as the legitimate nominee of a major political party, and yet many of the leading figures in the party have done very little to help him. Many have badmouthed him. Many have openly opposed him. And he feels that the party owe him, as the legitimate winner of the primary process, their support. So we've never seen anything like this before, quite frankly. And yes, in a normal election year, the nominee would be accorded the almost uniform support of the major figures within his or her party, and that would just be unquestioned. But with Donald Trump, it's been an entirely different dynamic this year.
All right. That's Professor Mark Rozell of George Mason University. Well, turning now to what's been trending online, G. Abby Lee joining me. I can only imagine, G, there's lots of buzz about Wednesday night's debate.
Online users are loving Wednesday night's moderator, Chris Wallace. Many people said the Fox News anchor did the best job out of all the other moderators this year. People are also tweeting, he did well on fact-checking and controlling the crowd. Exactly. At one point he said, Mr. Trump, I am not a potted plant here. I get to ask questions. And a lot of people tweeted that comment. But Wallace was also the one to tell people to settle down when the crowd started laughing when Trump said, nobody respects women more than me.
And speaking of that, are people also talking about his nasty woman comment?
Oh my goodness, Twitter definitely had a great time with that one. Towards the end of the debate, Trump called Clinton a nasty woman while she was talking, and women's editor at Huffington Post, Elena Vagianos, tweeted this. You know what a hashtag nasty woman is good at? Voting. On the other hand, Trump supporters were saying, yeah, she is in fact a nasty woman for what she did in Benghazi and also the email scandal. Hashtag nasty woman is a trending hashtag, and some feminists are saying they want to be a quote-unquote nasty woman for Halloween.
Interesting. I don't know how they're going to portray nasty woman as a costume, but what else is trending?
An online bank is having a social media campaign, and that's getting a lot of attention because free money. It so happens that we're in one of the 10 cities where we can get to look for lucky pennies. What it is that Ally Bank launched a campaign to raise appreciation for the lowest value coin by hiding special coins worth $1,000 throughout the country. They're described as slightly bigger than actual pennies, and the 10 cities include Detroit, Miami, and Washington, D.C. And the faux pennies are apparently located in plain sight in public places. So keep looking for them.
So how do people find it?
So that's the big draw for Ally. The bank will post hints about the lucky pennies locations on its Twitter, so if you want to find these coins, you better follow them at Ally. That's all for me today.
All right, thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A Mexican judge denies an appeal by El Chapo against extradition to the U.S. Russia IDs the suspected hacker and protests his planned extradition. U.S. Defense Secretary strongly condemning a failed North Korean missile launch. And artificial intelligence-created music is getting better. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. VOA's International Edition continues. While the world is watching the U.S. presidential campaign, Americans are having election anxiety that is apparently very real. The American Psychological Association just released a preliminary data from its annual Stress in America report on the nation's level of anxiety specifically surrounding this election. And joining me now to talk more about it, New York-based psychologist Jonathan Alpert. Thank you so much for being with us here. The survey found that about half the people that they interviewed, or 52%, say the election is a source of stress in their lives.
I'm actually surprised it's just 52. My practice is well over 52% of the clients are stressed out and anxious about the election, and quite frankly, tired of election news. They want it to be over. You know, they would like it to end right now, but they do have 3 more weeks and perhaps longer.
Would you say that the stress you're seeing from this election is more so than in years past when we had other presidential campaigns?
You know, I think we have two unique candidates, and neither seem very well liked or loved, particularly on the Republican side, but Hillary doesn't seem to necessarily be the party's favorite or especially loved. So we have two really unpopular candidates, and I think that just creates a highly polarizing situation. And people that love Trump will love him, and people that hate Trump will hate him, and I think things are pretty well set. As far as older people being most distraught or stressed over the election, I think it's probably because there's not a whole lot of dignity, and a system that we have in place has pretty dramatically changed in terms of the rhetoric and talking about someone's sexual exploits or alleged assaults or the size of his hands and email servers and all this. So what's mm-hmm. being lost in this election are the people, and
yeah.
particularly the older people. Their concerns perhaps are not being heard or even discussed.
And the oldest Americans seem to be the most worried about it, according to that that study by the American
yeah.
Psychological Association, but they were followed next by millennials.
Yeah, the millennials, I think perhaps they just have certain expectations and they're being unmet. There are a lot of, I think, Bernie fans who are millennials, and they're just disappointed. They're disappointed with the second choice of Hillary, and they're obviously not mm-hmm. okay with the Republican side.
What about the impact on couples that might have opposing views on the election? How do you...
With the couples, I started to see issues back in the winter during the primaries, especially during the Republican primaries, where one person maybe supported Trump and another person maybe supported Jeb Bush. And it just would create this firestorm and a great hostility at home. And political views are so far-reaching, and they can speak about social concerns or viewpoints. So it just had like great depth, and couples would come in and they would talk about the tensions at home. With a lot of these couples, their relationship wasn't necessarily intact or the strongest to begin with. So every 4 years, this issue might come up, and then they can sort of put it to rest.
What do you advise your patients as far as how to manage this election anxiety?
A lot of times people like to complain but not do anything about it. So one of the things that I think can be really helpful is if people actually take some action and do something about it. And that might be volunteering, making calls, working with a campaign, but to do something productive. And, of course, to vote, because a lot of people will complain about the outcome, but then come to find out, didn't even vote. So I think people should exercise their freedom and do their part. And then also a lot of tensions arise at work. Even at the local pub, people
mm-hmm.
discussing their political views. So I think it's perfectly okay just to say, you know what, I really don't like to discuss politics, and establish some boundaries with colleagues and friends.
All right. New York psychotherapist Jonathan Alpert, we appreciate it. Well, in the United States, it looks like more and more Americans are buying homes as the market continues to recover from the 2008 recession. The new real estate survey by Seattle-based Zillow finding many of these homes are being purchased by young adults, known widely as millennials. Zillow senior economist Aaron Terrazas tells VOA's Victor Beatty, for years the housing market was pretty much a bleak prospect for young Americans struggling with student debt, low wages, and an inability to come up with a down payment.
For so long, we were talking about millennials kind of struggling to leave their parents' basement, kind of doubling up in rentals. And suddenly, the data in the survey show that as the economy's improved, incomes are growing again, the labor market has tightened substantially, they're moving out of their parents' basement, and they're doing what people and Americans generation after generation have always done. They're renting, and then they're starting to buy homes once they feel secure. This is really a story about how far we've come since the housing bust, but also how much has changed since the pre-crisis years.
Well, Aaron, we've talked about the term millennials in the past, but define the age group we're talking about.
So we're talking about young adults, roughly from 34 and under. So these are really the cohort that graduated college and entered the labor market during the recession. The recession was their formative kind of young adult years.
Aaron, there is another newly released survey from a group called NeighborWorks America that raises questions about the Zillow survey and the ability of younger people to buy a home, specifically those who are straddled with large student debt.
There's no doubt that young adults are continuing to struggle in the housing market. You know, rents have been growing very quickly for most of the past 6 years, outpacing incomes. And so our survey actually did find that those young adults who are buying tend to be more affluent, better educated, more likely to have dual income households. When you look at the data, the home ownership rate for young adults who are married and have kind of two incomes, that's, you know, your traditional two-worker household, they have a very high and still high home ownership rate. So yes, so young adults who have not achieved those landmarks, kind of a stable job, a strong educational background, they're still struggling, and there's a lot to be concerned there.
That's Zillow senior economist Aaron Terrazas speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Well, nearly a week after the military operation to recapture Iraq's second city of Mosul from the Islamic State, the anticipated exodus of civilians has unfolded precisely as top United Nations officials had warned. A UN-run camp in Syria is now trying its best to provide food, shelter, and a safe place for thousands of Iraqis who risked their lives to leave Mosul. Many more are expected to arrive in the coming days. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks to Alun McDonald, Middle East regional spokesperson for the British-based organization Save the Children, about his organization's concerns surrounding these children and civilians.
Our main concern is the civilians inside Mosul. Mosul is the city, the vast majority of people are civilians. We think there are about 500,000 or 600,000 children inside the city, and these families are completely trapped. They know that the offensive is getting closer and the fighting is going to escalate, but there's no way out of the city. So they really face an impossible choice of either staying put and potentially being caught up in the crossfire and the bombing, or trying to flee but having to run a gauntlet of snipers and landmines and booby traps that have been planted around the city. So whatever they choose, whether it's to stay or go, they face extreme danger.
What about efforts to flee, to go to a Syrian refugee camp?
In the past few weeks, ahead of the offensive, and in the past couple of days, we've seen more people crossing into Syria from Iraq. So these are people mostly from villages around Mosul who managed to flee somehow and get across the border, but they're living now or taking shelter now in a extremely basic camp just across the border, where there's very little clean water, there's very little sanitation. There's a big fear that as the camp gets more overcrowded, as more people keep arriving, that conditions are going to keep getting worse. And the UN, so far we've seen a few thousand cross the border into Syria, but the UN is expecting that anything up to 100,000 might cross in the coming weeks as the offensive escalates. So this is going to become a much, much bigger crisis there.
So this sounds like a terribly desperate situation. I guess people within the city can't get out. Those who are outside are trying to flee into Syria, which of course has its own problems, and into a camp that's not able to really help or, you know, take care of the amount of people coming in.
That's right. The camps are very, very stretched. There's going to be enormous pressure on them when people start arriving in large numbers. At the moment, we're just seeing a few thousand moving from around Mosul, but we're expecting anything up to 1 million, or certainly hundreds of thousands of people who might flee once the offensive gets closer to the city in the next few weeks. And at the moment, there's only camps prepared for about 80,000 people, which is obviously a tiny amount of the people who might need help.
All right, that's Alun McDonald with Save the Children talking to VOA's Sarah Williams. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On November 8th, American voters will choose their next president. We'll provide you with the latest updates, Will it be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Will third-party candidates like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein have an impact on the final outcome? What does that mean for Americans and the world? It's all here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. The European Space Agency is uncertain whether its test probe has successfully landed on Mars as part of a landmark mission aimed to explore signs of life on the red planet. Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris.
The first part of the European Space Agency's ExoMars mission has been a success. Scientists began cheering Wednesday as their orbiter began circling the red planet. But at a news conference Thursday at ESA's Space Operations Center in Darmstadt, Germany, Solar Planetary Mission Director Andreas Accumazo said it was unclear whether the Schiaparelli probe had crashed or landed successfully on Mars.
There were some conditions under which the lander should have landed, and this we judge it as soft. Unfortunately, we are not in a position yet, but we will be, to determine the dynamic condition at which the lander has touched the ground, and then we know whether it could have survived structurally or not.
So far, ESA scientists have been unable to detect signals from the probe since it entered the Martian atmosphere. But they said the most important goals of the mission are intact. They gathered important information on how to land a probe for the second part of the mission, landing a rover on Mars in 2020 that will explore whether life exists below ground. ESA's Director General Jan Werner said the agency's trace gas orbiter is ready for work, studying trace gases like methane around the planet.
TGO is for us a cornerstone of the ExoMars 2016 as well as 2020 missions. So the readiness is fully confirmed and we are in full control of the spacecraft.
ESA failed in its last attempt to land a rover on Mars more than a decade ago. Two rovers sent by the U.S. NASA Space Agency are currently exploring the planet's dunes and craters. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Let's turn now to what is hot at U.S. movie theaters this weekend. Joining me now for details, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hey, Jeff, so Tom Cruise has a new movie out, I see.
We do. Tom Cruise is back as Jack Reacher, based on the best-selling novels by Lee Child. This one's based on Never Go Back. And I think Lee Child has written like 18 or 20 of these books. So Tom Cruise, this was his idea to bring this character back. You know, he gave us all the Ethan Hunt films, you know, with Mission Impossible. He's looking at mid-50s, and he's like, what, 54, 55, trying to find a new series for him to be an action hero. So if he keeps coming back to make these movies, there's plenty of novels for them to adapt. And this one is directed by Edward Zwick, who also did The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise a few years ago, which I really enjoyed. I thought that was really a well-based thriller. But he's returning as Jack Reacher this time around in Never Go Back. And, of course, he's a problem solver because he's accused of being of a murderer, and he also has to uncover a government conspiracy, and there's also an international arms dealer thing going on, and he also may have a child that he fathered 15 years ago. So there's all kinds of drama, all kinds of action for this kind of top-heavy action film. I mean, he gives us car chases. He's rib-busting punches. He leaps from rooftops. He uncovers government conspiracies. He escapes from prison, and he grinds his jaw through the whole movie. So It's just a lot piled onto this movie. Even though it's satisfying, it just kind of leaves you exhausted by the end of the film.
Wow. So good, bad?
I enjoyed it. I did. Even though I had a lot of problems with it, it's not as good as the first one. Because mm-hmm. The first one, he's a loner. I guess that's the character in all the books. He's a loner. This time, he's got a lot of people around him. So I think they're cramping his style. But it's not as good as the first one. I've got some problems with it, but I think it's an adequate thriller, and I'm a big Tom Cruise fan.
And then we've got a Halloween movie.
Yes, we do. Tyler Perry's character, Madea. Boo, a Madea Halloween from Tyler Perry. And you know, Madea has been to prison, has been to Christmas, has been to whatever. Tyler Perry's put Madea in just about every situation you can think of. Well, now it's time for Madea to have her own Halloween. So he ends up in the middle of the Halloween where he's fending off killers, paranormal poltergeists, ghosts, ghouls, zombies, also a group of misbehaving teenagers. So, you know, this is built in for all families. Tyler Perry loves, not only plays Madea, but he plays all these different characters in the movie. And this is just something you can take the family to. You don't have to see a horror film. If you don't want to see blood and guts, you want to see something funny and something thrilling, you know, Madea really delivers the laughs and also the thrill.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, thanks as always. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com.
I'm James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, that wraps up today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington, wishing you all a very happy day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
About 1 billion people, or every seventh person, suffers from at least one neglected tropical disease. Neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, are chronic disabling illnesses that thrive in areas with poor sanitation, lack of clean drinking water, and scant access to medication. NTDs have blinded, disabled, disfigured, and killed their victims for centuries, devastating individuals and entire communities. They affect the ability of children to thrive and to learn, and of adults to work, thus perpetuating the cycle of poverty. Nonetheless, most of these diseases are frequently preventable or treatable, often with low-cost medications. So 10 years ago, working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the United States government launched a public-private partnership to treat those who suffer from NTDs and to help prevent contamination and spread of the parasites that cause them through improved sanitation, preventive treatments, and mass drug distribution campaigns. Working in partnership with the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, the Conrad Hilton Foundation, the Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Trust, and many more, USAID has been instrumental in the delivery of more than 1.6 billion treatments to prevent and treat seven of the most common NTDs. Some 743 million people across 25 countries directly benefited from these treatments. Much of the medication was donated by pharmaceutical companies, which have given over $11 billion worth of drugs free of charge to the countries where USAID supports mass treatment campaigns. Moving forward, over the next 5 years, USAID and its partners plan to provide 1.3 billion treatments, leverage $6 billion in donated drugs, and prevent more than 585 million cases of NTDs. The partners hope to eliminate trachoma, the world's leading cause of preventable blindness, lymphatic filariasis, a painful and disfiguring parasitic infection transmitted by mosquitoes, and to break the transmission of diseases like schistosomiasis by improving sanitation. Working together with our partners over the past 10 years, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith, we have figured out an approach that works, and freed over 100 million people from these parasitic worms and bacterial infections that have held communities back for too long. Now is the time to double down and reach scale.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for